Hello, everybody. You are listening to Corpse Run Radio. This is Ian Hazzikostas, and enjoy.
Children of the grave, heed my call. Come and join me, or feel my wrath. For we are the Forsaken. I am your queen, and this is Corpse Run Radio.
This is Corpse Run Radio.
We are the Forsaken. We are the Forsaken.
Hello and welcome to episode 36 of Corpse Run Radio. As you all know, the Alpha for Battle for Azeroth has officially launched. I am not going to go into the content all too much because I don't want people to be spoiled, since for me there's nothing worse than being spoiled myself. So there are some general things that I'm going to cover over the coming weeks and month, but nothing specific, nothing lore-wise. So you can feel perfectly safe. Should there be something that is spoilery, I will definitely provide you with a time code for the segment so you can skip them if you so choose. That being said, let's get on with the show for today. First up, we have Slightly Impressive with 5 reasons to visit Elven Forest.
Looking for a reason to visit the beautiful zone of Elwynn Forest?
No.
Well, I've got 5.
1.
Did you know that Elwynn Forest was named after the legendary Hearthstone victory of a woman named El?
Yes! I'm the champion!
Wait, who win?
Who win? Elwynn. Aren't you paying attention?
And that's how it happened.
Are you sure that's the real lore?
2.
Elwynn Forest is the natural habitat of the human species. At Northshire Abbey, the human spawning grounds, you can watch in awe as newborn humans take their first few steps in the world.
Wow, this game looks so awesome!
Alright, alt number 37, here we go!
Quickly, to the Goldshire Inn!
3.
Pumpkins! Everyone knows humans' diet consists of 99% pumpkins, so it only makes sense that their homeland would be filled with them.
Looks so delicious.
What?
4.
Eastvale Logging Camp. It's a bit out of the way, sure, but you don't want to pass up the opportunity to experience this quaint little operation where the good people of Elwynn work tirelessly day and night to cut down, about 7 trees. Good job, guys!
Maybe I should have brought an axe or something.
5.
Of course we can't leave out Stormwind City. This iconic bastion of Alliance pride and glory isn't just the capital of something or other, it's also the only city in all of Azeroth with anything even close to a logical layout. The different districts even have color-coded rooftops for your convenience.
I remember the day they forced us to paint our roof. It used to be a lovely lavender color, but that fascist Varian forced us to comply with his oppressive zoning laws.
Well, anyway, Stormwind also has Stormwind Stockade, arguably the most fun you'll ever have walking down a hallway. And it's conveniently located right in the middle of the city.
Isn't that kind of dangerous?
Yeah, not to mention bad for property values.
No, it's fine. See, it's in the middle of the canal. Perfectly safe.
What's that other building just like it over there? Another prison?
Oh, no, it's nothing. It's just, nothing.
You were totally right. I am so glad we never opened this to the public.
Yeah, told ya.
We're going to
So we gotta take action. Let's recruit that boy.
and the lorry, and the naval front. Make me wanna say la 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 la,
la 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 la,
la 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 la,
la 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 la.
There's one place where we need to go.
We're going to.
I'm one true Pamela. Bow wow wow. I'm one true Pamela. Bow wow wow.
Check it out.
Check it out.
You're looking sexy with that straight back.
No hunch.
Man, I'm freaking out.
This
blood troll going to attack.
Oh, no.
I never leveled a druid, but the thought is born. I wanna be a raptor in my travel form. Now gather up the trolls, let me blow that horn.
What?
Cause there's one sub-race
that I really
want. Really want.
The
Zendalari.
And
the naval front.
Naval front.
Makes me wanna say la la la.
La 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 la
la la la
la la.
And there's one place where we need to go.
Tazdingo.
Eh, eh oh eh oh. I'm one true family. Bow wow wow. Eh, eh oh eh oh. I'm one true family. Bow wow wow.
Party in
Boulder,
Alliance are coming for you.
La-la.
There's no one who can match our power.
La-la.
So stay for the voodoo
La-la.
And let's get high.
Oh,
first we're gonna dance.
Oh!
Ha! 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 I'm with two Zendala.
That last song was Kavo's Zendalar. I so look forward to go there, finding out about the Blood Elves. But no spoilers. Anyway, next up we have some lore about the Call of the Scarabs, Michael Holliday, and the surrounding lore from Silithus and all that stuff with Noble 87.
Hello everyone! The Call of the Scarab Micro Holiday is upon us once again. After a year of your faction being represented within Silithus, it's time to once again honor the call and fight for the right to fly your banner at Ankiraj. But what exactly is the story behind all of this? That's what we're going to be talking about today. It all begins way back when, at the moment where the Titans found a little planet called Azeroth with a slumbering Titan spirit inside. The world was corrupted with the malevolent evil of the old gods, but the Titans, with the use of their keepers, they were able to contain their threats and give Azeroth a fighting chance. In the land, later known as Silithus, they housed the old god C'Fun in a subterranean prison, which was later expanded on by Keeper Ra and his Titan Force followers. The Anubis of Giants and the Leonine Tolvir labored day and night until they constructed the mighty fortress that we now know as Ankiraj. Keeper Ra then ordered his followers to safeguard the stronghold, as he himself would spend the following ages roaming the southern regions of Azeroth. During the battles with the old gods, the keepers had to also deal with their forces. Amongst them were the Akir, insectoids of incredible resilience and strength. They were born from organic matter that seeped from the old god's blighted forms. While in time, the keepers destroyed most of the Akiri race, small pockets of the insectoids, those that had tunneled deep underground, they escaped the keepers' wrath. Many years later, trolls would foolishly perform vile rituals and living sacrifices to awaken the Gafrax, a mighty faceless one also born from the old god's organic matter. This faceless one was known as Gafix. They succeeded, and the Gafrax woke up, He looked upon the troll civilization with nothing but contempt, for it was but a pale shadow of what the Black Empire, the empire of the old gods ruling the world before the Titan showed up, once was. Gifix knew it would delight the old gods to see this puny civilization rent to ashes, and he found a race of creatures to aid him with this task, the Akir, which it could control. The swarms were rallied, driving them to make war and establish their dominance over Azeroth once again. As Gifix took its time to expand its power and recover, the Akir began building a vast subterranean empire known as Ash-Akir. He patiently watched and waited as the Akiri ranks rose in number. When the time was right, the Kafrax led the insectoids from the underground empire and they swept across the land. At first, the trolls were overwhelmed by this force, something like this they had never faced before, but soon enough, the Zandalari took charge and the trolls pushed back. The Drakari, they pushed into the frigid north near Ulduar. The Imani set their eyes on defeating Kefix, building a new settlement of Zul'aman on the spot where they defeated the Kafrax. While the Gurubashi, they decided to go southwest where the Akir had overrun Ankiraj. The Titan forts left inside were corrupted, enslaved by the insectoids, and early engagements between the Gurubashi and the Akir, they proved disastrous for the trolls. The insectoids and their mighty Anubisov slaughtered several large Gurubashi encampments. Thereafter, the Zandalari instructed Gurubashi priests to separate the tribe into smaller, more mobile raiding groups instead of large armies. This new tactic, it allowed them to constantly harass the Akir, bleeding the insectoid armies dry over a period of many years. Though they were never able to completely wipe out the Akir, the Gurubashi eventually won uncontested control of the surrounding territory. With their leader, with the Kafrax gone, the rest of the Akir, they no longer fought with as much ferocity or purpose. After many centuries of brutal battles between trolls and the insectoids, the trolls were able to shatter the Akir Empire. The remaining insectoids, they were contained to the far northern and southern reaches of the continent. Those that survived fortified the underground colonies against further troll attacks. They showed no more interest in fighting, and in time, the trolls proclaimed themselves victorious. But their victory, it did not mean the end of the Akir. Under the influence of the old gods nearby, change started to happen, and three distinct cultures would arise from the Akir Empire. The insectoids in the north, they gathered near the underground prison of Yaxaron. Due to their proximity to the old god, these Akir would gradually evolve into a race called the Nerubians. The Akir in the southeast, they congregated where Yashiraj's essence still polluted the land. These insectoids would eventually transform into a race called the Mentids. Now the Akir in the southwest, they made their home in Ankaraj, where Kafun's foul presence would slowly warp the Akir's form over time, molding them into a race known as the Karaji. Since their defeat against the Troll Empire, the descendants of the Akiri had stayed hidden in their subterranean domains. Only the Mentid of Pandaria, they remained an active threat, and nearly all of Azeroth races had all but forgotten the ruthless potential of the insectoid colonies that lurk beneath the earth. Within Ankiraj's lifeless sandstone corridors, the insectoids lay dormant. Even when Azshara made contact with Sargeras, they tried to summon the Legion into the world, which ultimately resulted in the sundering of the land. Though Azshara and her Night Elf Empire had once upon a time known of the fortress, its existence had become all but lost to time. Ankaraj wouldn't be rediscovered by the elves until Archdruid Fendel Stackhelm, 975 years before the Dark Portal opened up. And to keep that in perspective, it was around 10,000 years ago when Azshara made contact with Sargeras. So 975 years before the Dark Portal opened up, they came up with a brilliant idea to regrow the land of Silithus. Fendrel sent out his warrior stunt Valstun and a group of his most trusted druids to perform this task. They trudged across the scalding dunes, searching for hidden water reservoirs that they could use to transform the region into a lush forest. Valstun and his comrades eventually stumbled across Ankiraj. Although some of the druids cautioned against entering the fortress, Valstun did it anyways. His presence in the cold dead halls inadvertently rose the dormant Karaji back to life. From its prison beneath Ankaraj, Kafun also became aware of the awakened Karaji. The old god drove the insectoids into a murderous frenzy. The highest classes of the Karaji society, they began organizing their lesser minions, the most numerous of which were known as the Silifids. These vicious insectoids, they came in many forms, and all of them obeyed the will of their Karaji overlords. The discovery of the Karaji, it shocked Valstun and his druid companions. Upon retreating from Ankaraj, they established a small outpost in Silifus to keep watch over the insectoids. Before their eyes, the fortress swelled with greater and greater numbers of Karaji. Then, without warning, a massive army spilled forth from the tunnels beneath Ankaraj. At the head of this swarming host were the Karaji, They directed their Silphid minions to engulf the surrounding deserts and spread into the other regions as well. By this time, Volstan very wisely had called for help from his father. Fendral rallied a force of druids, sentinels, priestess and keepers of the grove to deal with the Khorasi threats. In the southern reaches of Kalimdor, the Night Elf hosts clashed with their vicious foes. At times, they managed to drive the Khorasi back towards the dunes of Silphus, only for the insectoids to mount a counterattack and regain the advantage. This ebb and flow continued for many months, leaving in its wake the broken corpses of elves and insectoids alike. Fendral and his comrades, they established outposts across southern Kalimdor. From these locations, they continued a brutal fight against the Khorasi. Eventually, the tireless druids and their allies, they managed to push the Khorasi back into the heart of Silphus itself. Yet, just as victory seemed within reach, the war took a dire turn. News had reached them that the town of Southwind Village was under attack. Now Fendral, he considered pulling his troops back to defend his village, but he sensed that such an action would only leave an open door to invasion from the remaining Khorasi. They still had no idea of just how many the insects numbered, or even if they'd seen all that this new race had to throw at them. It was Volstan who offered to lead a detachment to this village so that Fendral could stay behind and provide containment. The thought of all of this being a ruse, it had crossed their minds, but they simply couldn't take the chance. The village had to be defended, and Volstan promised his father that he would remain victorious. Upholding the honor of his name. Reluctantly, Fendral nodded. Just return alive, and I will be more than satisfied. For the next few days, they battled wave after wave of Silphids streaming from the hives scattered throughout the land. On the third day, the Khorasi appeared, their numbers reinforced. Once again, the buzz of insect wings stirred within the air. They spread about before Fendral and the others, like the shadow caused by a giant cloud obscuring the sun, and then they simply stopped and waited. Fendral formed his lines and stood at the forefront as the oceans of insects parted and the hulking form of the Khorasi general approached. He carried a wounded figure in its clawed appendage. It proceeded to the front of the Khorasi lines and held Volstam's stack helm aloft for all to see. Gauze spread throughout the ranks. Fendral simply stood mute, knowing that Southwind had fallen and fearing that his son may already be dead. He cursed himself for allowing the boy to leave, and he stood frozen by a mixture of fear, anger, and despair. Within the general's claw, Volstan stirred, and he spoke to the general, though he was too far away to be heard. At once, the spell that had fallen over Fendral broke, and he bolted forward, followed by the Night Elf forces, but the distance was great. The Khorasi general fixed his second claw onto Volstan's bloodied form, and with both, he squeezed and pulled apart, separating the young Night Elf's body at the waist. Volstan's death, it shattered the Archdruid and sowed uncertainty throughout the Night Elf's ranks. The Khorasi seized the opportunity, and they swarmed out of Silphus once again, pushing into the eastern deserts of Teneris. They even dared to assault the sanctum of the Bronze Dragonflight, the Caverns of Time, which in turn pushed the Bronze Dragonflight into action. Led by Anachronos, they enlisted the help of Kelastras, child of Alexstrasza from the Red Dragonflight, Marifra, child of Ysera of the Green, and Aragos, child of Melagos from the Blue. The mighty dragons joined the Night Elf's host and helped drive the Khorasi armies back behind the walls of Ankaraj. But even with the mighty dragons joining the war, there were simply too many Khorasi to vanquish entirely, not to mention that the old god Khafun was still empowering their forces. Fendral feared that the war would never end. Thousands of elves had already perished at the claws of the insectoids, and he was loath to sacrifice more of his people. Ultimately, he and the dragons came up with a plan to lock the insectoids within Ankaraj itself. Fendral called on his druids to focus their powers as one. Along with Anachronos, the elf summons a great barricade to close off Ankaraj. Marifra, Kalastras, and Aragos, they sacrifice themselves by pushing into the city and holding off the Khorasi long enough for the rest of the forces to create the magical barrier. Outside the cursed city, the dry earth split wide, and a magical barrier of stone and colossal roots emerged. This impenetrable scarab wall towered high over the barren landscape, effectively sealing the Khorasi within their city forever. As a final act, Anachronos forged two mystical artifacts. He motioned to a scarab scuttling below his feet. The creature froze, then flattened out, transforming into metallic gong. Stone shifted into place near the wall, creating a dais where the scarab gong was finally placed. The great dragon then proceeded to the severed limb of one of his fallen companions. He held the appendage, and after a series of incantations, the limb morphed into the shape of a scepter, the scepter of the shifting sands. Handing the scepter to the archdruid, the dragon told Fandral that should any mortal ever wish to pass the magical barrier and access the ancient city, they need only to strike the scepter against the gong and the gates would open. Fandral looked down, his face twisted in contempt. I want nothing to do with Silphus, the Karaji, and least of all any damn dragons. With that, Fandral swung the enchanted object into the magical gates, where it splintered in a shower of fragments, and he walked away. Fandral found no solace in ending the Karaji threat, for Valstan's death still tormented his heart. The pieces of the Scepter of the Shifting Sands, they became lost for the next 1,000 years, but the need to re-enter the city, that would arise during classic World of Warcraft, as the old god Cthulhu, he incited the Karaji to frenzy, and both the Allies and Horde prepared for a massive war effort to preemptively deal with this threat. To do so, they had to breach the Scarab Wall, which meant reforging the Scepter, while also funding a war effort by bringing a whole bunch of resources together. We're talking about ore, fish, leather, herbs, bandages. Wars ain't cheap, and the amount was quite absurd, but then again, this was a server-wide cross-faction effort which took months to complete. In the meantime, someone had to go through the incredibly long, and when I say long, I mean long questline to get the scepter reforged, which is unfortunately no longer available in-game. It all began with getting your reputation to neutral with the Brood of Nosdormu faction. Pedestal of the Shifting Sands in Sonarian Hold, he was turned into a watcher by the Bronze Dragonflight, and he offers the chance to prove our worth. First, we check if his master Anachronos has returned at the Carousel of Time, which confirms to him that it is as it should be, the Great One is risen, and there's no time to waste. A hero must be found, and this might be us, if we're able to slay Broodlord Lashlayer and return with his head. Only then can we begin the reputation grind by slaying Silphus at Hive Ashi, Hive Zora, and Hive Regal. They drop carapace fragments, 200 can be repeatedly turned in at Pedestal to increase the reputation. Or, if the gates have already been opened up, you can also get reputation from killing the bosses inside of Ankaraj. Upon finally reaching neutral, we become worthy to talk with his master, while he's also kind enough to give us a tome, which tells us the tale of the War of the Shifting Sands. Its contents no longer fully lines up with the story that we know from the Chronicles and the short story, but the essence is still the same. An essence also shown after checking out a single crystalline tear near the Sacred Barrier, as a vision of the past shows us the dragons sacrificing themselves, the wall is created, and Falstad shatters the scepter. After learning about the past, we return to Anachronos, who lets us know that, of course, he gathered the shattered pieces of the scepter, and he returned them to the Caverns of Time. He had every intention of protecting it from those that would seek to use it to cause harm to our worlds. Thus was born the Charge of the Dragonflights, a scepter divided amongst the four mighty aspects that will prove to be nearly impossible to restore for those willfully seeking chaos, or at least, that's what he thought. Time has not been kind to the Dragonflights, whether by agents of the old gods or betrayal by those that would call them friends. Each guardian of a piece of the scepter has fallen to tragedy. We need to seek them out and prepare ourselves for the worst. Anachronos still holds his piece, and no shard will be given to the corrupted black Dragonflights, which means that our quest aims at the red, green, and the blue Dragonflights. The red one is the simplest of the three, but by no means is it easy. Heroes had to venture into Blackwing Lair and talk with Vilastras the Corrupt, the second boss of the raid. He actually came here in an attempt to kill Nefarian, but the black dragon proved to be more powerful, and he corrupts the red, turning him against us.
Now he shall serve me by slaughtering you. Get up, little red worm, and destroy them.
It is in his darkest hour that one should rise to relieve him of the shards, but sadly, Nefarian has taken it from him, and he plans to destroy it. This means that the raid only had 5 hours to complete the entire raid, slay Nefarian, and take the red scepter shard of his corpse before he destroys it. Like I said, simple enough, but not easy to do. Not a green one that had heroes travel to the Temple of Atal Hakkar, also known as the Sunken Temple, to find the Shade of Arrhenicus. After Ysera, the green dragon aspect smashed the temple to stop the Atalai's plan to summon Hakkar the Soul Flayer. Arrhenicus and a few others, they were sent in to deal with the remaining Atalai priest and stop their plans. Inside, they were somewhat successful, yet still fell to the corruption of the Emerald Nightmare. Now you might remember dealing with the Nightmare during Legion. That was like the second coming of the Nightmare. nightmare, this was before all of that played out, so something had to be done about Irenicus' corruption before we could retrieve the shards. The image of Melfurion, he sends us to Darnassus to inform Taranda, which then sends us to the Moonglade to talk with Keeper Remulus. He in turn then sends us to the four dream portals over Azeroth, located in Ashenvale, Duskwood, Feralis, and the Hinterlands. From the Dragonkin nearby these portals, we were able to farm a fragment of the nightmare's corruption, while the one in Duskwood had us fight a 40-man raid satyr known as the Twilight Corruptor. With these four fragments gathered, we lured Irenicus out, and of course, we had to show restraint. The green dragon was not inherently evil, he was corrupted by the nightmare, and with the blessing of a loon called upon by Taranda, we were able to cleanse the green dragon. In gratitude, he offered his green shard while returning to the dream to aid his beloved Ysera in the war against the nightmare. Then, the final shard we need, the blue one, that quest line was just insanely long. This shard was held by the blue dragon Azuragos, a world boss during Classic World of Warcraft, but you could talk to him either living or in his spirit form. The blue didn't really care about guarding the shard for very long. He knew that it would only give him trouble, while all he wants is to be left alone to his studies, and not babysit some would-be hero's ticket to glory. So it was that he came up with the brilliant plan to give it to a fish, but not any kind of fish, a very special minnow, which he granted some very special powers. Now the waters of the sea, they're vast, and they contain many minnows, but not to worry, to draw out this special fishy, we had to create an Arcanite buoy. His minnow would then be attracted to the magical emanations. When he gets near the buoy, blammo, it will expose in a glorious pulse of arcane energy, revealing the minnow's true form. We also may or may not incur the wrath of Neptulon the Tidehunter, but hey, what's life without a little bit of risk? The blue dragon is even kind enough to give us the schematics for it, schematics brought over to the gnome Narian Sufancy, but he can't read it since it's written in Draconic. We need to figure out what Azuragos has written down, which requires his scrying goggles, a 500-pound chicken, and volume 2 of Draconic for Dummies. The scrying goggles, they were taken by his ex-best friend for life, or as Stuval would call it, slave for life, who we tracked down, but unfortunately he lost the goggles while going through the Molten Core, so we kill minions inside the raids until it drops. The 500-pound chicken that's cooked up by Dirge Quickleaf after killing Lord Lekmarin on the Isle of Dread and gathering some chimeric tenderloins, deep rock salt, and rocket fuel. The Draconic for Dummies that was hidden away by the gnome on an island so far out that we can't actually reach it without dying from fatigue. Thankfully, Meredith the Mermaiden is there to help us out. She's quite taken by the gnome, and she wants us to deliver a love letter to him. Now he's not really interested, you know, a gnome and a fish, that would never work out. But she is kind enough to thereafter give us a swimming speed buff, which allows us to reach the island, only to discover that the book has been stolen by none other than Narian's archenemy, Dr. Weevil. We try to outsmart him, but this backfires and the good doctor destroys the book. The only known copy of it was ripped into 8 parts and scattered to the wind. One is taken from the body of Dr. Weevil. One is dropped from demons in the Blasted Lands. One from demons in Winterspring. One is found in the Undercity. One in the Stormwind Keep Library. One on the body of Onyxia. One in Blackwing Lair. And finally, one dropped of Ragnaros the Fire Lord. After all that, we're still not quite done yet. To actually make the damn thing, Nerain needs 20 Arcanite bars, 10 Elementium Ignots, 10 Blue Sapphires, and 10 Azerothian Diamonds. Those, let me tell you, were not cheap back in the day, but all of that combined, it does give us what we need. Off the coast of Azura, we spawn Moss, the minnow carrying the shard, and finally, with all four combined, we can reforge the Scepter of the Shifting Sands. Now all we need to do is wait for the war effort to complete, for the Horde and Alliance to gather enough resources. And after 5 days of transporting the troops, we can finally bang the Scarab Gong, tear down the wall, and start the 10-hour war server event.
You are already dead.
A global message was spread. Champion of the Bronze Dragonflight has rung the Scarab Gong. The ancient gates of Ankaraj open, revealing the horrors of a forgotten war. Like the days of old, we had to face against General Rajak and all of his powerful minions. We even ventured into the Titan facility itself, and we took on not just the Silifat and the Karaji, but even the manifestation of the old god Kafoon himself. The three dragons that sacrificed themselves, they've spent all the time locked up inside, but were able to set them free and even score some sexy gear. Now you might wonder, what exactly do we reward those that have been able to forge the scepter? Well, those that rang the gong first, or even within the 10 hours of the first one, you'd be rewarded with a unique black Karaji battle tank. Although many varieties of Karashi battle tanks can still be found in the ruins of Ankarash today, the darkest of the species were only seen on the day that the Scarab Gong was rung. The Scarab Lord title that will forever mark those crazy enough to fuse the scepter, which in the short story is done by the Night Elf Priestess Shiromar, a veteran of the War of the Shifting Sands. While the first player to do this was named Kalahad on the US server of Medivh, who rang the gong in January of 2006. This is why we celebrate and remember the call of the Scarab, where 12 years ago a bloody war was triggered by a simple sound. No rallying fanfare, no bloodthirsty yell, just an eerie silence, and many, many realms that simply crashed because they couldn't handle that many people in one single zone. Today though, we celebrate the heroics of those past adventurers by returning to Sylphus and walking in their footsteps. What's more, this is a competition between the Horde and Alliance. Whichever group can earn more credits earns the right to fly their flag next to the gong for the rest of the year. Earning credits, that can be done by world quests, turning in resources, taking on the forces of the Karaji and the Twilight's Hammer. Faction pride, that is going to be our reward. But some data mine information, it reveals that the new models we've seen used in Sylphus, they're also going to be applied to temporary mounts available during this micro holiday. Surprisingly, they also decided to give those that already had the Black Karaji battle tank, they got an updated new version on top of the one that they already possessed. That means to those few lucky enough to be around during Classic, and those that used that small window of opportunity due to a bug, I believe it was during Wrath of the Lich King, they now get a shinier, brighter model. This has been received with mixed responses. Now, I personally don't really care. I didn't have the mount to begin with. I already have like 300 mounts that I don't use. So I don't really care if they give an updated one to those that already had it. I doubt it took them a whole lot of resources to recolor the temporary mounts and make it permanent, but I do wonder why exactly they did this. It doesn't affect a whole bunch of players, since it's no longer obtainable, and the response, like I said, some feel like they're missing out just because they didn't play back in those days. Will they now also add new models to other mounts that are no longer obtainable? I don't see the massive benefit to it, considering that it rewards such a small group, but again, to me, I don't really care. I was talking with Peculia about this from wowhead.com, and she came up with a suggestion that perhaps, and this is just a tinfoil moment, perhaps in the future they could add like a time walking opening of AQ event, which would reopen the whole forging of the scepter quest line and give players another chance at this mount. If they're going to do that, I'm going to be all over that. The research for this video, it was difficult, considering that a whole lot of things have been removed by now, but it was also really fun to do, and I would love to experience this quest line for myself. Despite playing back then, I wasn't crazy enough to go through all of this. My part was just turning in resources and completely missing out on the opening of the gates, because I either couldn't log in with the whole servers overloaded, or I was out for a job interview, I don't really remember. Either way, this is all the story that I have for you when it comes to the background for this micro holiday. From bringing order to Azeroth and imprisoning Cthulhu within Ankarash, to the Horde and Alliance figuring out that evil was stirring once again, and the wall erected at the end of the War of the Shifting Sands that had to be brought down. I really hope you enjoyed it, everyone. As always, subscribe if you like my videos, leave a like if you enjoyed this one, and until next time, guys. See ya!
I suppose I should tell you what this monk is thinking. I'm reading through the patch notes and I still can't believe it. I won't be spamming on my heels or topping anyway, cause I'm already ooming, I just got in the raid. If I told you about my cooldowns, you'd make me reroll. I guess revival's pretty handy for killing my soul. Another trait to break, uh-huh, there's clouds to make, but by the time I've used my gift, already too late. Sometimes it's hard to play my monk in raids. I'll go ahead and play her anyway. Forget the trees and grow a pair of fists. It's hard, it's hard, it's hard out here for me. Miss Weaver, for a miss, for a miss, Weaver. It's hard out here for a miss, Weaver, for a miss, for a miss, Weaver. My mana's a joke, but I can drink some tea, wish me luck that I don't choke. I should probably use my crane, cause I'm so out of range. My 88k AoE heal just got messed up halfway. Don't you wanna bring this
monk who's gonna moan about her class. I guess there's gotta be a healer that will always be last. You know my master's a beast, uh-huh, you're in for a treat. When I be hitting life cocoon, you'll be swept off your feet. Sometimes it's hard to play my monk in raids. I'll go ahead and play her anyway. Forget the trees and grow a pair of fists. It's hard, it's hard, it's hard out here for me.
That was Charm with her Heart Out Here for a Mistweaver. I must say, my raid team, my current raid team, our healing team consists of two priests, one disc and one holy, and two Mistweavers. And to be perfectly honest, I really like the Mistweaver healing. It's quite good. So I think compared to what Charm has been singing about, either they turned some knobs there, or, well, anyway. Next up we have Hazel from Hazelnut Games with her top 10 cutest Battle for Azeroth pets.
Hi, I'm Hazel, and in this video I'm going to be counting down my picks for the top 10 cutest pet models that have been data mined from the Battle for Azeroth Alpha. Of course, Alpha is Alpha, and none of these are guaranteed to make it into the game. Before I start counting, honorable mention to this goat, this demon dart goat thing. The reason why it doesn't get an official number on this list is this is basically just a really heavily reskinned Argy, but I'm hoping that it goes into the game as an in-game obtainable pet so that there is a version of that model for people that don't want to spend the 10 bucks in the store. And it's remarkable that despite how clearly evil they tried to make this thing look, it's still adorable. Number 10, the Prairie Dog. So historically, I think that the Prairie Dog has a fairly undisputed spot as one of the oldest and worst models in the game, the original one. It was as close as you can get to a rectangle and still be able to call it an animal. I would imagine that this one is going to function kind of like the mouse and the sheep reskins that we got in Legion, where it actually replaces older versions of the pets, but you never know, it could be like the deer, where we still had the old ones and the new ones just became available as new pets. But it's nice to see it getting some love. Number 9, this baby Komodo dragon. Now this thing looks almost like a shrunk down creature model, or maybe it's just a regular creature model and it's my brain shrinking it out of hope. So maybe it wouldn't even be a battle pet, but you know, I have a feeling that this would make a really good one. If not in BFA, at least like 3 expansions later when they do Raiding with Leashes BFA, maybe then we'll be able to get it, who knows. The amount of detail on this model makes it kind of look like a figurine that belongs like on a shelf at your house, and then when people ask you how much you paid for it, you lie because you're embarrassed. Number 8, the baby turtle. This is another one of those model updates where we had a baby turtle and now we have a newer baby turtle, and this one I think is a really great improvement. They've almost given him a beak, and now I need to go look up some actual pictures of real turtles to find out if they do in fact have beaks. I've heard of turtles biting people before. Is it like a bite or is it like a peck? If you have ever been pecked by a turtle, share your story below. Number 7, the ferret. As I always like to say, there is nothing quite like a good old-fashioned fur noodle. This thing is super cute, and it looks very cuddly, although when I look at it head-on, it looks a lot like a lemur. And I'm not really all that familiar with ferrets in real life, so I don't know if they do look like lemurs, or if it's just this one that's kind of giving me a lemur vibe. But in any case, the ferret looks good, and I kind of hope that this one gets sized up as a hunter pet as well, because I think it would be really cool to see hunters running around with big, big, big ferrets. Number 6, this little baby blood troll beast thing. Separate from the model, there was a Datamined pet listing with the name Dart, and I will be flabbergasted if there is not a version of this that is called Dart, because that's just the most obvious Stranger Things reference that I've ever seen in my life. But it looks pretty good, you know, considering that this thing is basically a leech with feet, and if you give it a hug, it will probably bleed. I think that this is a pretty cute pet. Number 5, the Saurolophus. I have no idea how to say that, so if I butchered it, I am sorry. I mentioned briefly in my mount model ranking video that I have a huge, huge soft nostalgia spot for The Land Before Time, and this thing is basically ducky. And it also looks a little bit like an actual duck. This is one of those pet models that I think is going to look really, really cute when it's at the intended size, but much like my opinion of Toddle, I think that once you feed it a pet biscuit and then get it to several times its intended size, this thing is going to be terrifying. Number 4, updated cat models, and there are variations. We have Cat, we have Shaggy Cat, we have Pudgy Cat, we have Pudgy Shaggy Cat, we have just all sorts of unkempt cats, and I am here for all of them. The fat cat models in particular, though, have like a lot of neck pudge that made me a little bit concerned for their fictional health, but then I realized, you know, in my headcanon of these fat Battle for Azeroth cats, you know, they're designed to be like that. They're healthy. They're just fulfilling their true purpose. Number 3, the baby Brontosaurus. Now, I think that taking a four-legged, long-necked lizard thing and then making it small and cute is probably a tall order, but man, did they nail it! Look at it! Look at its little head! It still has the long neck, but it's not like an awkwardly long neck. And overall, I just basically need it. A lot of the pets in this list have like that engineered cute oversized head with extra oversized eyes model that is typically mostly relegated to store pets, so I'm hoping that these aren't all store pet models. I'm assuming at least one of them's gotta be. But either way, as soon as they let me, I am taking one of these home. Just try and stop me. Number 2, the baby pig. There are a bunch of different colors of this, and some of the colors feature like muddy legs and then like an extra muddy butt, and then some of them have no mud just in case you prefer your pigs to be squeaky clean. But I think that the muddy version is really cute. I feel like that's what, you know, I think it makes him look happier. I feel like that's what probably makes baby pigs happy. I've never met a baby pig, although now I want to. And I feel like he just looks like he's having a great day. You know, this thing belongs on a movie poster. You could use this model to create a new 3D animated version of Charlotte's Web, and I would probably watch it despite the fact that I cry every time. If Blizzard is somehow inhumane enough to make these a creature model that is then the target of like a kill quest, I'm not sure that I would be able to do it. Or more accurately, I would probably be absentmindedly questing while doing something else, and then I would realize that I'm halfway through slaughtering just like a family of adorable baby pigs, and that's just emotional trauma waiting to happen. Finally, number 1. Are you ready for this? Are you ready for this? I gotta sit up for this. Check out this chicken! Check out this chicken! It's a silky chicken! I forgot about these things! Okay, so in order to understand why this thing is my absolute favorite, one, it can't see, look at its fluffy head, but two, I have a mild history with chickens. I grew up with chickens, and at the time I never wanted chickens again, but it's been quite a few years and I just forgot how much I love these things. The thing that makes these things both really just ridiculous and adorable is the attitude and the way that they move. Because, you know, chickens, they're kind of proud, you know? They're a little bit cocky. They got a little bit of like chicken swagger going on. You should visit some chickens if you don't believe me. And when you add on just like the ridiculous head floof and like their feet floofs, and it's just the best thing ever. So I'm just so glad that somebody at Blizzard likes chickens enough to make this happen and make it real, because I'm so excited. The regular chicken models are also getting an update and they look pretty cool too, but these silky ones are just, what if they made these into a mount? What if they made the silky chicken into a mount? Would that be too much? Anyways, those are my top 10 picks for the cutest Datamined battle pet models that are not guaranteed to be battle pet models, but when you look at them, I mean, come on, what else are they gonna be? Thank you so much for watching. Please subscribe to my channel and opt into notifications if you would like to see more videos like this, especially as the BFA development process continues. Let me know what you think and have a wonderful, wonderful day. Bye.
Oh, Ludra the Mage here.
And I'm Ben the Mage.
Ben, there's a travesty in this world. Azeroth has done a grave injustice.
Wait, is this that Horde versus Alliance stuff again? Look, I told you, I'm out. It is just not happening with me.
No, Ben. No. This is far worse. You see our new race friends? Do not have new racial pets!
Wait, is this like something they decided on, or is it just an oversight? What's going on?
No, they're nowhere to be found! None! Not a word! Not even a whisper! About where their new vendor pets are, Ben! I'm so sad for them! I'm so sad!
Okay, that's it. I'm gonna protest this. Here, hold my beer.
While Ben is off protesting the injustice, that is, non-representation, tune into Battle Pets, episode 123, where we discuss this grave oversight, ponder ideas about what could have been, or still could be, and discuss other various goings-ons in Azeroth.
Okay, I'm back. You won't believe how simple that was.
What did you do? Is it fixed already?
I took a number. Now I just have to wait for my turn, and they shall hear of my mighty wrath.
Now, Carla, number 23.
Sweet! Only 154 more to go.
It's just Fizz 1, no need to stress. I know that we can get this boss. Let's start the countdown. Take Swamp and Strikes to win their best. Just so comes when the raid's across. As we all run round. He said, look out for the ruiner cast and spread reverberate and strike. We're taking him down. So when protocol is cast at last, we run to where we've been assigned.
We came in prepared for a fight. And I know this time we're gonna get it right. We came in prepared for a fight. King of the Road. Oh, oh, and we're dancing. I say Mercedes for this phase. Come here, Fell Reaver. Demolishers always at first. Nobody wants to stack these days. Frankly, me neither. The other two, just remember abilities from Worldbreaker. Easy to weather. Now we're right back to P1 again. Just keep on dodging orbs and then. Keep on dodging orbs and then we'll win together.
We came in prepared for a fight. King of the Road. Oh, oh. And we're dancing around orbs again tonight. King of the Road. Oh, oh. Take swapping every forging strike. King of the
Silvula Tomy with her song about the fight versus Kingaroth in Antorus, the Burning Throne. This is the end of episode 36. I would like to thank the following contributors. Slightly Impressive, Cabo350, Noble87, Charm, Hazelnutty Games, Silvula Tomy, and Hero Maradex's Villain's Corner about Kel'Thuzad is going to be the last segment of the show today. I hope you've enjoyed this episode of Corpse Run Radio. I have started a Twitch channel for the show named Cops Run Radio, and I'm going to start streaming there in the coming days, weeks. I'm most likely going to start off with leveling a couple of allied races, characters, and then I hope I eventually will get a alpha or beta key so I can stream some of the content for Battle for Azeroth, but that remains to be seen, obviously, since it's not my decision. If you have questions, suggestions, or other input for the show, you can write an email to corpserunradiomail@gmail.com. You can find us on the Twitter at corpserunradio, and you can find us on Facebook at corpserunradio on the channel there. Have a great week. Have a great remainder of the Love is in the Air Festival and the upcoming Lunar Festival. Until next time, bye guys.
Kel'Thuzad, probably the most iconic lich in Warcraft, and the end boss of Vanilla WoW, plus the first end boss of Wrath of the Lich King. This Villain's Corner video will go over the most requested character to ever be added to Heroes of the Storm. Kel'Thuzad was a top-ranking member in Dalaran, and a very accomplished mage, who was both rich and powerful. But he had an obsession with necromancy, and was always experimenting with bringing rats back to life. He was also frustrated that he couldn't do more than just bring rats back to life. And that's why he answered the Lich King's summon. You see, at this time, the Lich King was just Ner'zhul bound to the armor at the Frozen Throne, and he was tasked with building an undead army. So he sent out a psychic message to anyone who was in tune with the dark arts to come to Northrend and meet with him if they wanted to learn more, which was perfect for Kel'Thuzad, whose life goal was to learn more about necromancy. It just so happened that, also around the same time, the Kirin Tor found out about his experiments with bringing rats back to life and told him to cut it out. So instead, he just sold all of his stuff and decided to head north. When he reached Northrend, he came across Nerubians, who were very obviously undead, which greatly excited him. He had a hard enough time bringing rodents back to life, and he was one of the top mages in Dalaran. And then, here we have these giant bug creatures who could move and think on their own, walking about in service to the Lich King. Kel'Thuzad then eventually met with the new Barak, the leader of the Nerubians, and was given a nice little tour of Naxxramas, since they had been expecting some new recruits to show up. While inside Naxxramas, Kel'Thuzad was shown the plague for the first time, the stuff that would kill people and then turn them undead and loyal to the Lich King, and saw it used on a sick woman who immediately killed and ate her husband after turning into a zombie. The sight of this freaked Kel'Thuzad out so much that he teleported out of Naxxramas to throw up. Of course, he was followed outside, and after getting over the initial shock, he decided that he was kinda into it, and decided to meet up with the Lich King anyway. So Kel'Thuzad was brought before the Lich King and sworn to work for him and do whatever, and the Lich King was like, "Alright, sounds good. Don't ever betray me though," and then gave him the power he wanted, plus sent him out on a mission to create the Cult of the Damned, and to infect the kingdom of Lordaeron with the plague. So Kel'Thuzad went back to Lordaeron and tried his best to convert the people of the land into his new death cult that was all about destroying all life on Azeroth in return for immortality. And Kel'Thuzad had a much easier time than he thought he would finding followers. So for the next few years, he went around recruiting people and preparing the plague. Finally, once the Lich King thought Kel'Thuzad had enough followers, he gave them the plague to be set in cultist-controlled villages and to unleash it on the population. This chemical warfare of poisoning people to death who would then immediately be rezzed in service to the Lich King also worked surprisingly well, and there was a huge outbreak of undead everywhere thanks to Kel'Thuzad. And then this is where Arthas enters the picture. You see, on one of Kel'Thuzad's outings of spreading the plague, he was caught by Arthas and Jaina and ran away. But Arthas chased him down and killed him. But not before Kel'Thuzad could tell him about the impending tragedy that would befall Strathholm. So Arthas went out and did his thing. More info on this time period will be explained in the Arthas video, but suffice to say, Arthas went out, obtained the Frostmourne, and became part of the Lich King, came back to his hometown, caused a bunch of mayhem, and finally went out in search for Kel'Thuzad's body. Once he was found, Kel'Thuzad told Arthas that the Dreadlords he was working with were not to be trusted, and his real mission was to help free Ner'zhul from the Legion. But first, he'd need his body back. So Arthas went out and waged war with Silver Moon City, and killed about 90% of the High Elven population, all to use the Sunwell to bring Kel'Thuzad back to life. This was probably one of the single most important events to the lore of the Blood Elves in Sylvanas, but it's just kind of a footnote for Kel'Thuzad. After being brought back to life, he told Arthas the whole plan. Basically, the Lich King Ner'zhul was in service to the Burning Legion, and the whole thing with the Scourge was just to weaken the world before the Burning Legion could launch an invasion. Since he succeeded in his first part, it was time for him to go into part two of summoning the Legion. But surprise, surprise, all of this was actually just a clever ruse by Ner'zhul to free himself from the Legion's control. You see, Ner'zhul pretended to help the Legion so that the Legion would slowly, over time, give him more and more control and freedom. And once he was sufficiently self-sufficient and no longer being watched over by the Dreadlords, he planned to rebel and take his freedom back. And Kel'Thuzad was all about helping him do this, like to a fanatical degree, as he was basically the guy who did all of the legwork for the Lich King. So part two of his plan was to go to Dalaran with Arthas and steal the Book of Medivh, which would allow them to summon Archimonde into the world. And during this invasion on Dalaran, Arthas managed to kill Antonidas, the leader of the mages of Dalaran, and Jaina's teacher. Pretty important dude, but then again, that's kind of Arthas' deal, killing a crap ton of important lore characters. After a successful invasion of Dalaran, Kel'Thuzad got the Book of Medivh and summoned Archimonde into the world. Archimonde then destroyed the city of Dalaran, and gave control of the Scourge to the Dreadlords. With this, it was time to enact the final part of the Lich King's plan. With the demons focused on their conquest of the world, and the unstoppable Scourge army now in control of the Legion as well, the Legion was finally turning a blind eye to the Lich King, which is what he needed in order to free himself and become self-sufficient. So Kel'Thuzad told Arthas what he needed to do in order to help the people of the world win against the Legion, which, like everything else in Ner'zhul's plan, was incredibly convoluted and involved helping Illidan get the Skull of Gul'dan so he'd kill the final Dreadlord who was keeping him in check. While Arthas went out and did his thing, Kel'Thuzad just waited for him to return in Lordaeron with the Banshee Sylvanas. After the Legion was defeated, Arthas eventually came back and told Kel'Thuzad that he was the king now and should be addressed as such. Kel'Thuzad, who I might stress here, was like super loyal to the Lich King, was all for this, as Arthas was the Lich King's chosen champion and was incredibly happy to see him return. So with the Legion invasion on Azeroth over, Kel'Thuzad and Arthas chased the remaining Dreadlords off and worked on rebuilding the Scourge army. But Arthas started suffering seizures and began weakening. Turns out, he'd been away from Northrend for too long and really needed to go back to the Frozen Throne to recharge. Of course, this made Kel'Thuzad really anxious and worried, so he prepared ships and transport back to Northrend right away. But during this time, the Dreadlords came back and ambushed them, and in the ambush, separated Arthas from Kel'Thuzad. Kel'Thuzad then told Arthas to meet up in the forest and to escape the city, and worked on freeing himself from the city as well. Kel'Thuzad eventually managed to get out of the city, only to find Arthas poisoned and surrounded by Sylvanas and her banshees. He then immediately killed all of Sylvanas' banshees and chased her off, saving Arthas' life. It was then that Arthas thanked Kel'Thuzad and called him his best friend. The only time the Lich King, Arthas, called anyone a friend or equal, mind you. This was kind of a big deal. Then Arthas went off to Northrend to recover, and Kel'Thuzad was left in charge of watching over the land while he was gone. Kel'Thuzad swore to uphold his legacy at any cost, and went to the Eastern Plaguelands to rule from Naxxramas. From Nax, Kel'Thuzad went back to work in spreading the plague across Azeroth. Only this time, everyone was aware of it and actively fought back, so it didn't go anywhere near as smoothly as the first time. But he was having some middling success. During the years Kel'Thuzad was at his work, someone had created a special sword that was super effective at killing his undead minions, and could be a real threat to him. This sword, of course, was the Ashbringer, and Kel'Thuzad set out on a mission to either destroy it or claim it for himself. So with the help of Balnazar, the Dreadlord, who was friendly now for some reason, I should mention, Balnazar was one of the Dreadlords who attacked him in Arthas when he was weak, but, you know, whatever. They're working together now, and the Dreadlord was able to trick the wielder of the Ashbringer's son to kill his father with the sword. Since the sword is an embodiment of holy light, being used in such an evil manner corrupted the sword and turned it into the corrupted Ashbringer. Kel'Thuzad then grabbed Alexandros Morgreen's body, the wielder of the Ashbringer, turned him into a Death Knight, and gave him the corrupted Ashbringer. Then, sometime later, Darion Mograine, another one of Alexandros' sons, managed to stage a successful attack into Naxxramas, and kill his Death Knight father and steal the sword back. Kel'Thuzad then launched an attack on Lighthope's Chapel, where Darion was located with the Ashbringer, when Darion plunged the sword into his heart, killing himself, releasing the captured soul of his father, and causing a massive explosion that killed all of the lesser undead in the area, immediately stopping the invasion. After the battle was over and the dust settled, Kel'Thuzad went in and turned Darion into a Death Knight, and gave him the corrupted Ashbringer. With a powerful item like the Ashbringer in his control, he then set out to collect the pieces of Eidesh, the legendary staff that Medivh used. And he had pretty much most of the staff in his control, as when players go through Nax in Vanilla WoW, they can collect most of the parts needed to construct it from Nax, with a few parts being collected from elsewhere, and the base being a drop from C'Thun. And speaking of Vanilla WoW, this is when Kel'Thuzad came to his second death. With the combined might of the Scarlet Crusade, Argent Dawn, and the forces of the Horde and Alliance constantly attacking his forces in Plaguelands, Kel'Thuzad's army was severely diminished, and he was forced to retreat into Naxxramas. Players then managed to break through the defenses of Nax and launched a successful attack on Kel'Thuzad, who ended up being the final boss of Classic WoW, killing him and obtaining his phylactery. Now, what makes liches so powerful is the fact that they're basically immortal. If they die, they will simply just respawn at their phylactery, eventually. So any good lich will hide their phylactery somewhere safe, where no one could find it. But Kel'Thuzad carried his in his pocket for some reason. But luckily, one of Kel'Thuzad's followers had managed to infiltrate the Argent Dawn, and tricks players into giving him the phylactery, which he then promptly runs off to Northrend and allows Kel'Thuzad to reform. After reforming, Kel'Thuzad started helping out the Lich King in Northrend, and is seen in the Boren Tundra preparing some undead troops. He was also given control of Naxxramas once again, only this time in Dragonblight. And this time, the Horde and Alliance, lore-wise, were a lot more organized and powerful, and managed to sweep through Naxxramas once again, killing Kel'Thuzad for a third time. And this time, he didn't actually carry his phylactery on him. So, technically, lore-wise, Kel'Thuzad is still alive somewhere. Until information on his phylactery is found, he's basically assumed alive and in hiding somewhere, and could be reintroduced in the future. Okay, and that's it for the Villain's Corner segment on Kel'Thuzad. Kel'Thuzad is a very popular villain because he is very closely involved in the most popular villain in Warcraft, the Lich King. And if it wasn't for Kel'Thuzad being super successful in almost all of his plans, the Lich King probably wouldn't have ever freed himself from the Legion. Kel'Thuzad is probably one of the most successful villains in lore, with how much he accomplished, despite being killed 2 times in 2 raids in-game. If you have any suggestions for other villains to be covered, let me know in the comments. This particular villain was voted on by my Patreons, and I'll most likely use Patreon to vote on other ones in the future. Also, again, big thanks for Rachel for doing the drawings for this video. If you like this one, watch the one on Yogg-Saron as well, which I'll link at the end of this video right now.
Thank you for listening. Now go out, my minions. Let nothing stand in your way. Until next time.